This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, and welcome to the Q interview from CBC Podcast and from Q on CBC Radio. How are you? Thank you so much for streaming or downloading. I'm really excited about today's show. I'm really excited. I've been excited about this interview, I think, for 5 or 6 years. I think since I started on the show, I've been looking forward to talking to the guest today. But before we get to that, I want to let you know that if you like the podcast, please hit subscribe and rate and review. Coming up later in the show and at the end of the podcast, so you can skip there now if you want, but don't do that. Our good friend and producer of the Q Interview podcast, Caitlin Swan, will be here for some listener mail. If you have any questions, send them to me, q@cbc.ca. So, when the stand-up comedy special Nanette premiered on Netflix 4 years ago in June 2018, it was the first time a lot of us had ever heard of Hannah Gadsby. But that show, Nanette, pushes Hannah into international fame kind of overnight. The show goes on to win a Peabody and an Emmy Award. Hannah grew up in Tasmania in the 80s and 90s when the state was in a really toxic public debate over whether homosexuality should be a criminal act. It was only decriminalized in 1997, by the way. So Hannah Gadsby is also autistic and wasn't officially diagnosed until well into adulthood, after strangers had been kind of telling her that for years. This life in the margins is what Hannah writes about with incredible honesty with her new memoir, 10 Steps to Nanette, a memoir situation. So what happens when the success of Nanette happens to you? And I mean, sure, it's great to be called a deconstructionist of comedy, but what's it like to go to a comedy festival and feel like no one wants to talk to you? And what happens when you're writing a memoir and you realize the life you thought you led is so different than the one you're reflecting on? We talk about all this today. Hannah is currently touring her third international comedy show. The first two were Nanette and Douglas. The new one's called Body of Work. I'm happy to say I got the chance to talk to Hannah Gadsby about all of this. So I want to get one thing out of the way, though. This was my first day back from having COVID. So if I sound a bit croaky, that's the reason. I also want to let you know that you're going to hear some more of Nanette in the interview. It does contain a description of assault. Here's my conversation with Hannah Gadsby. Hannah, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yourself?
I'm not too bad. I'm not too bad. I'm losing my voice a little bit, but I'm all right. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
I saw you called writing this memoir a monumental pain in the spiritual arse of my life. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Look, I enjoy writing as a problem-solving exercise. But when the problem is your life, it turns you inside out a little bit. And I've sort of had an idiosyncratic life and not, you know, I was on the struggle bus for a good many years and hadn't sorted that out very well. And so through the process of writing the book, I had to really dig into some hot trauma memories, we'll call them. And it just took me a very long time and I didn't always enjoy it.
How are you feeling now that it's out there?
Just really happy to be done with it. It just hung over me for years, but I'm really proud of it as a piece of work. I think, you know, it's my first time really as a writer for the page. I think I did a good enough job, like to sort of draw a line under my life to make sense of my life, but opening myself up, but not too far.
I want to talk a little bit about your early days in just a second, but first I wanted to go to where I think most people listening to this might know you from, which is from Nanette. And you say this about when you first started to perform Nanette. You say, I got heckled, I got abused, I had people demanding refunds, I threw up, I cried myself to sleep, and that was just opening night. And without knowing that this was going to become sort of the earth-shattering phenom hit show that it became, what kept you performing Nanette despite all that?
You know, it wasn't a show that I did because I thought it was going to be successful or that even it should be successful. It was a compulsion. I felt I had something to say. I felt like nobody was saying it as I needed it to be said in the world.
Remember that story I told about that young man who almost beat me up? It was a very funny story. It was very funny. I made a lot of people laugh about his ignorance. And the reason I could do that is because I'm very good at this job. I actually am pretty good at controlling the tension. And I know how to balance that to get the laugh at the right place. But in order to balance the tension in the room with that story, I couldn't tell that story as it actually happened. Because I couldn't tell the part of the story where that man realised his mistake. And he came back. And he said, "Oh, no, I get it. You're a lady faggot. I'm allowed to beat the shit out of yous." And he did.
And I was sort of driven by that. Of course, being a comedian, I focus on the negatives. It's a gift we're all blessed with. You know, the most successful comedian in the world is still grizzling about negative feedback. But, you know, in that negative feedback, there was also a profound shift in the room, and many people did sort of let me know that they were incredibly moved by the show in the very early days as well. So, you know, for there was a push and a pull, and I the negative push was painful, but the pull won out in the end.
The pull is interesting to me because I read you say something like, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but I read you said something like, you know, the goal was to sort of cull the audience down from a very broad, wide audience into people who would get it and people who would care about me and people who would understand what I'm talking about and kind of shag everybody else, right? But what's the experience like when so many more people are there with you, are willing to sit there with you?
I think it's sort of this lesson that perhaps I needed to learn that, you know, I thought the only people who would get it were people who experienced, you know, life in a similar way or had similar experiences. But what the show was in the end, I guess, is in the act of vulnerability that it was a human show, and humans responded to it.
The last time you performed the show ever was here in Canada. It was in Montreal. What was that night like?
Funnily enough, the last time I performed Douglas as well was in Canada. I don't know what it is about you guys.
I'll try not to take the blame for it.
No, it's fine. I still resent you because you hide fruit in everything. Yeah. But other than that, I think you're great.
We do kind of hide fruit in everything.
You do. Yeah, you're nice. You're smiling, but then there's fruit.
Good luck getting yogurt without fruit in it.
Just wanted a piece of cake. Now there's got to be fruit in it. Anyway, what was the question? I've thrown myself off.
Oh, that's all right. What was it like when you performed Annette for the last time in Montreal?
It was a really difficult thing. Part of it was because it had already gone on to Netflix, and a lot of people who came to see the show were obviously then had seen the show. And so there were these moments that, you know, relied on tension and the audience not knowing what was going to happen next. And of course, you know, let's say even half the audience knowing that sort of killed that that mechanic of the show. So, you know, I'd be setting up and ready to put, you know, the end of my point on, but people were already cheering. And for me, that wasn't what the show is about. It is essentially a stand-up show in that the audience has to not know what's coming next. They can't sing along. And the other problem, the difficulty that I had there was I'd been performing Nanette in a bubble. You know, when I first started touring, it was in my usual festival circuit run in Australia and the UK. But even as I did that and the show was difficult to perform, I began to withdraw from my peers because it was just, you know, to self isolate for, to, you know, conserve energy. And then performing in New York, I was in a completely alien world. I'd never done that before. So by the time that I got to, you know, the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, I was sort of felt adrift from the stand-up world. And when I got there, I realized, you know, there was a lot of love for me, but there was more not love.
from who?
I think, you know, when it's professional jealousy, it happens in every field. But I think, you know, because I'm not from North America, I didn't go up through the ranks as perhaps people think you should. I came from nowhere. And in the process of coming from nowhere, I was pulling apart the art form. And so fair enough, other comedians like, you know, this, we're doing what we love. You're not doing it properly and you're rubbishing it. And then you get success. This is, you know, so there was, you felt the resentment. And that was a little shocking. But again, it was the push and the pull. There was love, but there was also resentment. And that was added to the intensity that the festival felt for me. But I'm coming back this year.
Oh, good. Yeah, I can imagine that might make for some awkward hallway conversations or something like that.
Well, you know, I am on the spectrum, so awkward hallway conversations is my specialty. But I'm as a rule, I don't meet, you know, looking people in the eyes, but now other people are not meeting, making an attempt to meet mine. So it's kind of a cool swap. I like it.
When you did Douglas there for the last time, was the experience any different?
Well, I wasn't doing it as part of the festival. So I was just, when you're touring, you know, on your own ticket, so to speak, it's a very, you know, it's that bubble. So I had a great, I mean, our audiences in Canada are fantastic.
Only except for the fruit.
That's not a part, as long as I don't throw it, we're fine.
let me reintroduce you here. My guest is the comedian Hannah Gadsby. Her new memoir is called 10 Steps to Nanette, a Memoir Situation. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the book and get some stories from the book here, where you tell the stories of your life sort of up to Nanette. And you grew up in a small town called Smithton in Tasmania, which you say was famous for two things, the Duck River and the McCain Frozen Food Factory. Can you paint me a picture of the Smithton of your childhood?
Yeah, it's in a really beautiful part of the world. Like, it is stunning. You've got some the Tarkine Wilderness on the west coast of Tasmania. Tasmania itself is incredible. It's sort of like, it's a very small island and as epic as New Zealand, but on a smaller scale, if that's even possible, because New Zealand's quite small. And so it's in this, you know, really rich volcanic earth and farmland surrounding it. But the town itself is built on industry. So it's not fancy and the people aren't fancy. And it's very isolated. And, you know, the Duck River had a fish factory on one side and a McCain's frozen food factory, which specialized a lot of potatoes grown. What are they? Chips, potato chips.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like, it smelt like bad fish and chips.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
And, but it was, you know, like at times when I'm reading it, you know, there were very, you know, very normal childhood things to do. Like, you were the youngest of five siblings and you tell the story about a game you used to play together called Towns. And I was wondering if you could explain the game and also maybe how you didn't quite fit into the game even then.
Well, I was the youngest of five, so I was, and I was happy there. Like I like to be told what to do. It would seem otherwise, you know, I seem contrary, but I really do try to fit in. There is real effort behind my inability. So
that's a good T-shirt.
Thank you. But it's not written on there. So then it's sort of, it's a real effort behind that inability to get it printed.
You'll have to imagine.
Yeah. Welcome to my world. But it's sort of, you know, all my brothers and sisters just sort of fell into the patterns of the kind of roles that you would expect. My older sister is sort of boss the town about. You know, the middle brother was the teacher. Actually, no, he was supposed to be the policeman and then he's become a teacher. And then my oldest brother was a bus driver. Hamish, who was closest to me in age, was the shopkeeper. And I just missed the memo. And I was like, I just want to be a dog. And they're like, no, you got to be a little bit more practical. It's like, nah, I just want a woof. But for, you know, a little bit longer than was okay. Like, I think they forgave me until I was like six. And they're like, come on. We're actually, you know, it got to the stage where they were playing this game because they were being nice older brothers and sisters. And it's like they're setting up this town just so I could be a dog. And I was like, nah, you got to at least be a doctor dog or something.
Did you what did you find funny back then? What was making you laugh when you were a kid?
Do you know, I was a very serious child. It might be surprising for people to know. Like, my life was sort of in the first quarter, we'll call it, was just a process of trying to work it out. So every new piece of information, I struggled to know if it was a joke or if it was serious.
Yeah.
It was very easy to lead me up the garden path, which my older siblings took great delight in doing. Telling, you know, I would believe things for way too long. So I had difficulty understanding what jokes were. The older I get and the more information I have, the better my ability to find humor, because I know what's the drill is now. So I laugh a lot more now that I'm older. But when I was younger, it was pretty basic, you know, but people often had to explain the jokes. So I laughed a little delayed.
Oh, yeah. Did you know that you were funny?
I worked out how to be funny. I did know that I was funny because people would laugh at me, but for a long time I didn't know what I'd said. And, you know, honestly, sometimes I'm on stage now, and especially when I'm building a show up, and people will laugh at something and I go, I'm not sure what they were laughing at, but they laughed. So I do it again the next night and the laugh's still there. And, you know, sometimes there are lines in my shows that stay in and I'm not entirely sure why they're funny.
Even now, hey?
Yeah, I think part of it has to do with my delivery. Like, sometimes I say something and mean a thing and I don't... there's an incongruity between what I mean and how I say it.
Did you ever, when you were a youngster, realize that you were funny intentionally? Like, you could say things that were funny?
Yeah. I worked out how to do that. So really, my favorite trick was to say things out of context. So, you know, I was a collector of phrases. I didn't say much, so I would collect phrases. And then, you know, at first it was a way to be able to have conversations. You repeat how other people, you know, you copy the way other people do. But when you get it wrong, the simplest one, and everyone does it, is when people say, you know, you say, hi, how are you? Good, thanks. So I worked out, you know, I could take things out of context. And my favorite thing was I'd memorize television ads. And, you know, because back in the day, everyone watched the same television, everyone understood the same ads, and everyone knew the same. I don't think this would work quite as well anymore, but I would just repeat ads out of context. So, you know, I can't even think of one because everyone I think of is like Weet-Bix or Vegemite. And I'm like,
oh, do Vegemite. Strange. We know Vegemite in Canada. We know Vegemite.
All right. Well, sort of like their tagline is, it puts a rose in every cheek. And, you know, so in class, you know, why did Hitler invade Poland? And I'd be like, he put a rose in everyone's cheeks, you know, so.
That would get a laugh. I understand that.
Right. Yeah. Inappropriate. I wouldn't get away with that anymore. But, you know, so I learned it was a craft, and it was a deflection technique because it made me feel included even while I was not sure what I was doing.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, like there was sort of this bright spot in your life, no matter what, when you were growing up, which was your neighbors in Smithton who were sort of like surrogate grandparents. And you call them Nan and Pop, even though they weren't necessarily your grandparents. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, I used to just... I'm a creature of habit, and I would go over after school every day and have a cup of tea and afternoon tea with them. And most likely, especially if it was sunny, a nap. And it was just the routine. And they were lovely. And a few years back, I was living and I had some kids who lived over the fence and they just kept coming to visit me. And it occurred to me then, I was like, oh my God, did my Nan and Pop actually want me to visit them every day? Because I'm not into this at all.
You realize what you'd done to poor Nan and Pop.
I know. I had held them hostage for biscuits. I talked to them like I didn't talk to anyone else. You know, I would, collect stories at school. You know, I didn't really get involved at school. I was just sort of watching and learning. But then I'd go to Nan and Pop's after school and then tell these big whoppers, as my mum would call them, about what I did at school, but just inserting myself into the thick of the action. And Nan knew, like, she'd just go, oh, yes, yeah. Of course, yes. So it was sort of where my family would be more cynical and call me out and wouldn't indulge me at all. It was a scrappy fight when you got five kids. I just felt like I was, I got this lovely calm attention that let me externalize what was inside of me a little bit.
Yeah, I'm struck. You say that like nothing really ever changed at Nan and Pop's.
No, I can still close my mind and, see everything. Like everything was always the same. I can walk through their house in my imagination and I know where everything is. Everything was in its place. And the rhythms, I found that really comforting. Our house was chaos. They had two clocks, one in the kitchen, one in the sunroom. And the one in the sunroom was always 5 minutes fast and the one in the kitchen was always 5 minutes slow. Even when, of course, you wind the clocks forward and back for daylight savings, they always, for some reason, did it wrong. Perhaps they thought it took 5 minutes to get from the sunroom to the kitchen. I don't know.
they built in a buffer.
Yeah.
I'm struck by the not changingness of their house in this way. And so you were diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder in 2016. And in the show we were just talking about in Douglas, you described this diagnosis as being handed the keys to the city of me. And Hannah, when you read the book and you look back on your life with these keys to the city in your hand, it's hard not to be struck by stories like this one, like the contrast of the sameness and the not changingness of Nan and Pop's versus, the sort of chaos of home or high school, which you describe as sort of a war zone of sound and smells. Does knowing that you had autism all this time alter or change the way you see some of the memories in this book?
Yeah, it's really quite interesting because I began writing this book well before I was diagnosed, well before I wrote Nanette. It was originally going to be just a collection of essays about little accidents that I had, which I began writing at it. And a lot of, particularly the first part of the book, a lot of that is what I wrote before I was diagnosed. And part of my issue with writing the book really was not understanding how I could be so intelligent and so naive and dense at the same time. And, I started to take out the bits that were embarrassing that I couldn't quite add up. And when I was diagnosed, I looked back through that writing and I'm like, oh, it makes sense through this lens why I struggled. Like I was friendly, but I couldn't make friends, And so I put that writing back in and was able to. So it was a self-acceptance thing. It's like I have a naivety and an innocence to me that I was always embarrassed about because I felt like I should know things and I just didn't. But again, there's a push and a pull. Because it takes me so long to make the connections, I make them thoroughly and I make more connections than most people. And so the older I get, I have a richer insight to things. And so at one time I thought you could easily be described as a disability and a disability only. If you're on the spectrum and you can push through, you're a late bloomer, I believe.
Yeah. It must be such a powerful feeling to be able to look back and physically write down these memories and make those kind of connections.
It is, and you know, not to use, I don't want to get too crunchy on it, but it is, I do look back with it, you know, I am very grateful to be able to do that, because honestly, I think a lot of people on the spectrum get traumatized early and they don't get a chance to recover that because, you know, there is just such an intense pressure to achieve and achieve early and to do things right and to do things right the first time around. And people on the spectrum are just not wired to do that. And you can come from a loving family, as I did, and still get thrown, you know, through the spin cycle. And damage gets done because of a lack of patience and an expectation of typical communication. So this part of the reason I feel compelled to keep on keeping on is just to sort of, you know, at once speak to people on the spectrum and give them some expressions in the world that reflect how they see it, but also people in, you have to interact with people on spectrum to just, you know, perhaps try some patience.
More with Hannah Gadsby right after whatever happens right now. Hope you enjoyed that little bit of promotion. Here's more of my conversation with Hannah Gadsby. In this memoir, 10 Steps to Nanette, you intersperse your personal story with the story of what was happening politically in Tasmania and culturally in Tasmania when you were growing up, primarily the anti-gay measures that were happening in the wake of AIDS. I mean, you described this sort of horrible AIDS commercial where they say it's not just gay people and IV drug users that get AIDS.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it.
It occurred to me that we're going to be airing this conversation you and I are having at the beginning of our own Pride Week here on this show. And in the book, you include these sort of historic homophobia times in the book, just to let people know exactly what the context was of what you were living through at the time. Why was it important for you to include these historic homophobia times?
Well, I did it because, you know, not sure who's going to read the book. On the one hand, there are people who are born after 1997 who are going to read it and not know. Because I think, and also there are people who are, you know, not gay and didn't live through it from this side of things, where it's very easy to forget that there was a toxic struggle. Because once rights are won, people kind of then just really quickly absorb that and think it's as it's always been. And the privileges that come with it, it feels like this is how it's always been. And I feel like we're living through a time where we're on the edge of losing a lot of rights. And I'm certainly aware of that when I was writing it, and I'm sad to say I was right. It really does feel like we're being pushed back on a lot of hard-fought rights. And so putting it into the context, I wanted to sort of, you know, show that the very same arguments we're hearing now existed way back in the 90s when I was growing up. And it did damage in ways that people don't want to acknowledge. People are always afraid of, you know, the anti-gay stuff in schools is always pitched as this, like, you're hurting children. But putting in homophobic laws hurts children. They hurt children. Having a toxic public debate about what you can and cannot say, it hurts children because it teaches some children that they're not equal, and it teaches other children that it's okay to treat others as if they have less rights.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to just sort of bring that into a contemporary conversation.
Yeah, like, what's the danger when we forget that there was a struggle behind? Because I think there's a pull to want to go, all right, so we did it, and now we don't need to look back. We can just live in the acceptance and happiness that we worked and fought for. Like, what happens when we forget that it was a struggle?
oh, because when it happens again, you don't recognize the signs.
Yeah.
You know, I think we forget, we just assimilate the information. We just sort of, like that was the bad old days and the people who did those things were ignorant. And they really, you know, like it's always a dodgy political game played by people who actually have no real vested interest in the subject. That I don't think the people who really push the, you know, the anti-gay rights things or, you know, the don't say gay things really care about homosexuality. Mm. They just care about stirring up a base. And I can see through that because I lived through that.
Your own mother's journey is something I was really taken by in this book, you know, whether that's her journey to accepting you as a queer person, that's whether that's her journey in sort of like recognizing you as a stand-up comic. One of my favorite moments is when you tell her you wanted to be a stand-up comic and she says, sure, I'm funnier than you.
Which she's not wrong. She's not wrong. She is. She is incredibly funny.
Hey, well, she had, that scene in the Hannah in that first when you first go on and do stand-up for the first time and she's heckling you and getting big laughs, or she's heckling other comedians and getting big laughs?
Mm. Yeah, it was, you know, she's not used to live performance. We did, you know, we're not from a place where there's theatre. You know, we're just from a place when everyone can, you know, heckle everyone. So that's, you know, she was nervous. So that's, and she'd had a couple of sherbets, so she was like fizzing. And so I, you know, so, and she's funny and she's incredible timing. So this one poor bloke got up and he was quite short and mum just sort of picked her moment when the crowd's really silent. And she's like, you know, he'd be taller if he sat down. And everyone just laughed and except me, because I'm just like, oh no, because I only had 5 minutes of material and I had a 7 minute set to do and all of my material was about mum. So I'm at the back shitting myself and everyone's just laughing going, who is this woman? The next comedian that got up and he's like, she had no time for him because he was doing this sort of, you know, left of field sort of, you know, mime kayaking stuff. It's very adorable, but, you know, a bit cerebral. And mum's just like, I don't understand you. And she was just, you know, I think he's talking about Starbucks, that's right. And yeah, she's like, what's Starbucks? And, of course, everyone's heard of Starbucks, except my mum legitimately hasn't. And so he's like, oh, you're just heckling me. I'm ignoring it. And she just wouldn't let it go. She's like, no, you need to tell me. And he's like, oh, it's like McDonald's for coffee? And she's like, oh, I thought it was a movie. And everyone just laughed. And then he got back on with his set, but then just in this little gap, she said, oh, no, I was thinking of Star Wars. Sorry. And he just walked off stage. Like, he's like, you've ended me. I can't. There's nothing I can say that'll be funnier than that.
If the timing is what gets me, Anna. Like,
yeah, it is.
And then I'm struck by, so your mom and your dad go to see Nanette. You left the trauma part out, right?
Oh, I took all the real, I mean, it was still a fiery show, but I took all the, you know, the worst stuff out of it. I just didn't, they didn't need to sit in a room full of strangers and hear that and be with that and feel that. Like, the show is not about punishing them. It's about punishing everyone else. No.
but then no. your mom goes to the Netflix taping in the Sydney Opera House.
I know. She just invited herself and it was just like, ah, like I couldn't say no, because on one hand, like, she's showing support, like, in a way that she hadn't. She always did, you know, it supported me, but this was like a real, like, going to Sydney was a big deal for mum, like, that she hadn't been there since, you know, she was a teenager and just really left her comfort zone for a very long time. So this was, you know, it was a huge thing. And as part of me is just like, yeah, but no, because I had to, there was no choice but to do that show in front of her. So it was, again, the push and the pull.
Go ahead.
Oh, it was, and it was incredibly difficult because I wanted to warn her before I did the show that there was going to, but she just, I think she knew on a level and she just wouldn't give me the chance. I just said, Mum, I need to talk to you. Well, no, anyway, bye.
were you able to focus on anything else? I know that from performing sometimes, if my mom's in the crowd or someone I know is in the crowd, I could have a big crowd in front of me, but all I'll think about is that one person. Like, were you able to, in such a powerful moment, when you,
it was,
you know, were you able to think about anything but her?
No, I was able to get into the show. Like, I'd done the show a lot by that stage. I'd been touring it a year. And, you know, it gets to a point where a show is in your bones and you walk out and you know the rhythms of it and that's where you're at. And you're delivering it to a room, not individuals. You're feeding off the energy of a crowd. And so I was able to get into that space. But because it was being filmed and the lights were up a bit, it's a matter of course, I can only see the first two rows, if that, of a crowd. But this, I could see the sea of heads out there. And my mum has a very distinctive sort of white crop of white hair. And my eyes just picked it up and then sort of like a quarter of the way through the show. And it was just a line of sight. And so then I was just hyper aware of mum. But in that sense, I think it worked. It's part of what I think makes the filmed version a powerful document, you know, in the sense, because sometimes it doesn't always translate. A live show doesn't translate to the screen. But I think we captured something here because I'm delivering this really painful show to the only person in the world whose pain would be equal to mine.
Mm. You've been very generous with your time. I just have two questions left. And one is sort of about that. It becomes this massive sort of cultural force, Nanette does, you know, and then that leads to you being this international star, you know, you're playing sold out theaters all over the world. You're touring your new show, Body of Work. You got these two big hit specials on Netflix, Nanette and Douglas. And in Nanette, you talk a lot about living in the margins. How has your relationship to comedy evolved as you become more and more successful in it?
Because I'm successful, I'm able to focus on the craft, which is a real privilege. You know, I have the ways and the means of working with the nuts and bolts of it, which is what I really love. And I'm able to create opportunities where I can, people pay tickets to see me. So they're primed to enjoy what I do. So that's not what you get when you first start doing comedy. Comedy is a really, really difficult thing to start in. I am afraid of not success, that seems fine, but it's more that sort of pressure of the crowd. I don't want to be someone who has stands. I really want people to come to each of my shows with a fresh mind to be challenged or to challenge me. Like, I feel I don't like, you know, that sort of intensity of fandom that seems to be a part and parcel with, you know, success.
Because you're worried they won't love your work for what it is, only just because you do it?
I'm not, you know, that's, you're in a position of power. And if people aren't thinking critically, then you get a response to something that's not deserving of a good response that needs pushback. And if nobody in your world is saying no, and then you get a whole crowd of people saying yes to something that's dodgy, yeah, then you're in a feedback loop. And I worry about what that does to your humanity.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, there's no one telling you not. No one telling you, Hannah, boy, that's a bad idea.
Yeah, but while ever my mum's alive, I'll be fine.
Before I go, last summer you were awarded an honorary doctorate of literature from the University of Tasmania. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
That'll put a rose on every cheek.
Hey!
Pretty good?
Yeah.
Thank you. You gave a speech to the graduating class, and you talked about something your wife says to you. Don't panic. Who do you want to be? I thought to close things off, you could tell me a little bit about what that question means to you at this stage in your life.
Yeah, it's actually part of what I've built my new show around as well, because I am prone, when I can't quite piece things together, I do spiral a little, and my brain will be, you know, what do I do? What am I supposed to do? What should I do? What do I do? What do I do? And she's worked out a way to sort of take the, you know, the pressure out of that and sort of says, stop, don't panic. Who do you want to be? And it's just works really well for me, because it just sort of, you know, you sort of think about not what you should do in the specifics, but how you want to approach things. What sort of person do you want to be? Sometimes there's no right choice, like no good choice, but that sort of thing sort of helps me take a step back from sort of troubling things.
Troubling thoughts one after another, yeah. And you can look at the bigger picture.
Mm.
Hannah, we're such big fans of you here, and I really loved getting a chance to read your story here, and thanks a lot for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I hope you're feeling better.
Yeah, like I said, I've been waiting 5-6 years. Like, I think what did Nanette came out in like 2018? So that was like maybe a year into the show or something like that. Like, I have this recollection of just, we always wanted to talk to Hannah Gadsby, and I'm so glad it finally happened, and I'm so glad we were able to have that particular conversation. Hannah Gadsby's memoir is called 10 Steps to Nanette, a Memoir Situation. In Vancouver, she'll be there doing a body of work on June 13th, and in Toronto, she's going to be there on July 8th and 9th. And no Regina dates, Caitlin.
Oh my God, I will riot.
This is our The Cue interview producer and the pride and joy of Regina, Saskatchewan, Caitlin Swan.
Hi, howdy.
You were just not, where were you just then?
Just then, like recently.
Yeah.
Physically, yeah. Mentally. Nova Scotia.
I love it out there.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Had a good lobster roll.
Did you have a lobster roll?
Gotta. Always. That's like the one thing I get out there.
Are they like $30?
Yep. Tastes good. So that's why I pay the big bucks.
Man, they are really expensive.
They are.
I was just in Boston, and you got to have a lobster roll.
And the donut.
You got to have a lobster. And the Boston cream donut, much cheaper. Yeah. Anyway, so I go over, and I get myself a lobster roll, and I'm like, and I've already ordered it before I look at the price.
Oh, lordy, lordy.
And it's $28 U.S.
Oh, no. So that's 40?
The Assam, our technical producer, has pointed out that a Boston cream donut in Boston, just called a cream donut.
See, that's that. No Boston creams there.
No, it's like just French. It's like French fries. They just call them fries. Newfoundland dogs in Newfoundland, we just call them dogs.
I've never heard of that though.
No,
the Newfoundland dogs.
You don't know about Newfoundland dogs?
Newfoundland dogs.
They have webbed feet. True story. That's true. It is true.
You're funny.
It's true.
Okay. You guys stop joking around 24/7 then, because I don't believe you.
I am the boy who cried Newfoundland dog.
You're the boy who cried web dog feet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Caitlin, you got some listener mail for me?
Yes, I do. So okay. I'm calling this I Love Sad Songs, and it comes from Dylan Curry in Swift Current, Saskatchewan. Have you ever been near that? Do you know where that
is? No. I've been to Saskatoon, and I've been to Regina.
And that's probably it.
Yeah, right? That's where I've been in Saskatchewan.
Cool. Swift Current is close to Regina. So this says, hey, Tom and Caitlin.
Hey, you got a shout out.
Me.
Pretty good.
That's my name.
Congratulations.
Just wanted to let you know how much I enjoy the Q Interview podcast. I've been loving all the interviews and was so excited to see you had Phoebe Bridgers on.
I love her.
Yes. She's such an incredible songwriter, and I really appreciated Tom's conversation with her. Mm-hmm. I also really appreciated the discussion you had around sad songs. Personally, as a songwriter myself, even as a former competitive hockey player who listened to Moonlight Sonata before warm-ups, in my own headphones, though, of course, as it's not exactly a popular dressing room choice.
It's not a jock jam.
No, not. No, doesn't get the boys up.
Excuse me?
Sorry.
Continue on.
I will...
It doesn't get the boys.
No,
Moonlight Sonata never gets the boys up.
You don't have to repeat it.
Sorry, keep going.
I've always connected so much more with sad songs or emotionally moving songs when seeking inspiration, motivation, and connection with others. What prompted me to message most, though, was actually your discussion around You Are My Sunshine following the interview. My mom also sang that song to me nearly every night as a boy, as a matter of fact, and your discussion really struck me and had me in tears when you broke down the lyrics, the kind of tears you get when you witness something truly beautiful. So thank you for that. Anyways, I just really wanted to thank you for the work you're both doing and the honest conversations you are engaging in with artists. You have an impact on me and so many others, I'm sure. And I just want you to know that your work is important and valid. Yeah, so I figured this was just a joke email. Somebody's just emailing in and saying all these nice things because we're humble. We are humble folk, and this can't be real.
It's more than an AI game. It's very, very kind. Dylan?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Dylan. Anytime I can ruin a childhood song for you, you just let me know. I could probably do it with a couple more, but You Are My Sunshine, unbelievably sad song.
Yeah, and it won't keep me from listening to it.
No, I put it on that night when I got home. I listened to the Norman Blake version of it.
God, love it.
Yeah, real pretty.
When I was in Nova Scotia, I listened to Big Rock Candy Mountain down the highway. Gotta love that one. You know, where the dogs all have rubber teeth. And the hens lay soft boiled eggs.
They sure do.
I'm surprised I remember that
There's a lake of stew and a ginger ale too, and you can paddle all around it in a big canoe.
I really like, and they hung the jerk that invented work.
Yeah.
Like, hell yeah, they did.
Yeah, that's a bit of that's a darker part of the song.
I like that one. I like that lyric. It's my favorite one.
You know, some other time I'll tell you a very weird secret about that song.
That's for our other podcast called Weird Secret Songs.
Weird Secret Folk Songs with Tom and Kate. Anyone call you Kate?
Bleh. Nope.
Got it? No, like not it. Kate. Tom and Caitlin.
Yeah.
Thank you, Caitlin.
You're welcome.
That is it for our podcast today. I'm on Instagram at Tom Joe Power. The podcast is on Instagram at CBCQ. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.